Good morning and welcome to the June 13, 2013 meeting of the San Luis Obispo Planning Commission. Planning Commissioner Chairman Irving was unable to attend today's meeting, so I will be your acting chair for today's meeting. Madam Clerk, would you call the roll?
Commissioner Christensen?
Here.
Commissioner Campbell?
Here.
Commissioner Topping?
Here.
And Chairperson Murphy?
Here. If you would all join me for a pledge to our flag.
To the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
I'll open the floor for public comment for any items not on today's agenda. I currently have no speaker slips. So I'll go ahead and close public comment. If there are any planning staff updates.
Yes, good morning, commissioners. I'm Nancy Orton with County Planning, and I'll just go over your schedule briefly. The June 27th meeting has been canceled, as you know. On July 11th, we'll have a half-day meeting. Commissioner Topping will be absent on that day. July 25th is looking like there could be a full day of items for you, and then so far there are a couple items on both meetings in August. So June 27th there will be no meeting.
All right, thank you. All right, we'll go to the consent agenda. Does any member of the public or commission wish to pull and speak to any item on the consent agenda? Seeing none, is there a motion to approve the consent agenda?
Motion to approve.
Is there a second?
Second.
Oops.
Sorry.
One of us.
All right. Second. Could you have to go ahead and call the roll, please?
Commissioner Murphy?
Yes.
Topping. Commissioner Topping.
Yes.
Commissioner Campbell.
Yes.
And Commissioner Christensen.
Yes.
All right. Consent agenda is approved. We'll go ahead and move to hearing number one. If you would introduce hearing number one, please.
SRK Investments, Inc. and T-Mobile for a minor use permit, coastal development permit. County file number DRC 20120042. Supervisorial District 2, Project Manager, Alexandra Fowler.
Very good. Does any commissioner have any ex parte they need to disclose? Seeing none, I will go to our staff, Alexandria Fowler and Aaron Sigwald.
Good morning, commissioners. The project before you this morning is a wireless communications facility, minor use permit, coastal development permit, number DRC 2012-00042, and the applicants are SRK Investments and T-Mobile. The project consists of a wireless communications facility that would include an increase in height of an existing architectural cupola feature by 3 feet with an FRP transparent material that would be textured and painted to match the existing building, installation of 4 new 56-inch high by 12-inch wide by 7.9-inch deep panel antennas, 2 installed per sector, mounted behind an extended architectural cupola at the center line height of 32 feet and 6 inches above the ground level. There would also include a conversion of an existing 11-foot by 8-foot storage room into a utility room for the proposed wireless communication facility, installation of 2 air conditioning condensers located on the existing second floor balcony outside of the proposed utility room, installation of 2 AC air handlers, 3 equipment cabinets, a battery rack, and associated multifamily and commercial retail, and San Simeon Village Acres is surrounded by agriculture. This is the site plan. Right here is the hotel building. This dotted area right here is where the proposed wireless communications facility would be located. This is an enlarged site plan. And this area over here is the proposed antenna layout, which would be installed inside the cupola. This is the cupola right here from the roof plan. And this is the location of where the proposed equipment layout would go in the new utility room. Down here is a spec for the proposed antenna. Right here is the west elevation. This is what you would see if you were driving along Highway 1. This is where the proposed cupola would be increased in height by approximately 3 feet. And behind this wall right here is where the proposed equipment room would be at. And there will be a photo that you'll see that will make it a little bit clearer for you. This is the north elevation showing the proposed increased height in the cupola. Here's the east elevation. This is the view that the residents from the that are located behind the hotel would have. And here is the south elevation. This is an existing photo of the site from taken from the northwest. The proposed equipment room would be located behind this wall right here. And the proposed antennas would be located within this cupola, which would be extended by 3 feet. This is a view of the site from the east. There are residents, multifamily residents that are back over here. And as you can see, the cupola is not visible at this time. It may be slightly visible with the 3 foot increase. Here's a photo simulation that was provided by the applicant. This is showing the 3 foot increase there. This is their option one. And then option two is the same 3 foot increase except for it has a decorative fascia. This is the existing coverage propagation map. Right here is the proposed location of the T-Mobile site. As you can see, this is where Hearst Castle is at, so there are some sites there. And this is Cambria, where T-Mobile also has sites. This is the proposed coverage propagation map. As you can see that there is now coverage in the San Simeon area. The issue with this particular project is the limitation on use standard. The North Coast Area Plan Limitation on Use Standard for San Simeon Acres Village Commercial Retail Land Use Category states the following. Principally permitted uses are limited to tourist-oriented uses, including eating and drinking facilities, not including drive-in restaurants, fast food, and refreshment stands, food and beverage retail sales limited to tourist-oriented supplies, general merchandise stores limited to tourist-oriented shops, and motels and hotels. Non-principally permitted uses are limited to public assembly and entertainment when accessory to a hotel and motel, caretaker's residence, service stations, bed and breakfast facilities, water wells and impoundments, and coastal access ways. This is a visitor-serving priority area. Because of this limitation on use, staff felt that we could not recommend approval of this particular project because the project is not consistent with that because telecommunications facilities are not listed within the limitations of use standard for the North Coast Area Plan. Staff concludes that the project generally complies with the visual and screening and other ordinance standards that would be applicable for wireless communication facilities. However, a communication facility is not an allowed use in the San Simeon commercial retail land use category, but it is an allowed use in a residential multifamily category in San Simeon. Staff's recommendation, therefore, is to deny the minor use permit, coastal development permit, DRC 2012-00042, based on the findings in Exhibit A. Staff would be more than happy to answer any questions that you have, and the applicant's representative is here to address any questions you may have as well.
Does any commissioner have questions for the staff at this point?
Just one quick one. You showed the photos of the various exposures of the building. Nothing's worse to look at than a couple of AC condensers, which have to be outside. It appears to me that perhaps they'd be on that second floor deck.
I'll go back to
it. Could be visibly not too desirable.
The AC units would actually be tucked right back here behind this building, so they wouldn't be visible from the public.
Okay, that was my concern.
Commissioner Topping?
Yeah, I have a series of questions about this one, but maybe I should wait
Yes.
Until we hear from the applicant.
If you'd like to, yeah. That'd be fine, and we come back to staff. Okay, if that's the case, we'd ask the applicant to come forward and make his presentation. How much time would you like? 10 or 15 minutes or less?
We apply the county guidelines for that. Unfortunately, there was sort of this conflict where there's a limitation of use that allowed for a site in residential zones. However, the guidelines by the county ordinance sort of direct us to stay away from residential uses and really try to incorporate our antennas into architectural features. So after evaluating the area and looking for the best siting locations, we decided to go with this property rather than a new freestanding structure on residential zone property, which would effectively impact views more, bring the antennas closer to residential uses, and create a new freestanding structure. So the building that we chose, we evaluated several different hotels throughout there. We were able to basically apply all of the guidelines, if it were allowed in this zone district, to this. We were able to incorporate the antennas into the cupola up top or the penthouse, screen the equipment and the condensers behind that wall. And we thought at the end we've got a very nice site that serves both the ordinance standard, if it were allowed here, but also the technical standards that T-Mobile needs for the project. We brought the project before the North Coast Advisory Committee, and that was approved by them, and I believe that those minutes are in the staff's presentation as well. And I think with that, our time is best served by availing myself to any questions that you have about either the design, the limitation of use, why we chose the project, or the need for it.
Commissioners have questions for the applicant?
Yeah, I have one.
Go ahead, Kim.
On the coverage, I think we had a map on that as well. Could you tell us a little bit about what this does for coverage and for whom?
Yeah. Mainly, the coverage will be best, or as far as I'll talk about the end user experience, will be kind of in San Simeon Village. Due to the fact that we're down at 35 feet, the signal has got a limited area of being able to propagate out to the north and to the south. So if you see the black arrow points towards that green area, which is excellent coverage after the site were to go on air. Yellow is sort of marginal coverage. Outdoors, you would still have really good coverage. Indoors would be maybe not as good and reliable. Up to the north, you can see the Hearst Castle site, which, due to the elevation up there, propagates quite a bit larger area. That has some unique characteristics up there in that there's a cluster of sites, and we're able to co-locate on an existing structure. And then to the south, you can see that little turquoise dot in Cambria, and that's the recent site that just went up on air. And that one pretty much covers all of the Cambria area pretty well, except for some of the residential homes to the south.
Is that Cambria site yours?
Yes, it is.
And so it benefits all users in the area, right?
All T-Mobile customers in Cambria, but the coverage drops off right about the time that you get back onto the Coast Highway heading north, and would not provide any coverage in the San Simeon area.
And this is the one that's in the Santa Rosa Church.
No, this one is a little bit further east. There's across from Lynn's Bakery. Okay. There's a four-story office complex.
Okay.
And we're up in the roof there behind some architectural screens as well.
Okay.
The antennas aren't visible, so unless you knew the site was there, it would just look like a regular building facade.
Yeah. All right. Well, so this is not. This won't benefit Moonstone Beach directly.
Unfortunately, the site will not propagate there. If we came back with maybe a 90-foot tall site, it would.
Yep.
But I don't want to fight that fight.
Sure.
So you currently have no cell service in San Simeon Village.
AT&T and T-Mobile have, they had a multi-year roaming agreement. So currently, T-Mobile roams on AT&T's network in the area, and that's going to expire at the end of this year. And so in anticipation for that, T-Mobile, dating back a few years ago, planned out several sites throughout this area. And this isn't a really robust coverage indoors. So what we're seeing is the technologies have progressed from kind of 2G to 3G, and now we're into 4G. People are really sort of cutting the cord and using it not only as a mobile talking device, but also browsing the internet, making reservations, booking tickets at Hearst Castle. And currently, that's not really possible with the coverage that's there. And so with this, and that's sort of our, I don't want to say argument, but position with staff, was that this limitation of use was very narrow in this zone district, to where it's just for sort of tourist-based lodging. And we're sort of an ancillary use to that, in the sense that I guess there are some people that want to escape not having coverage, but there's a lot of them that want to go on vacation and also be able to check in with the family back home and things of that nature.
Commissioner Campbell, you had your light on.
I guess I go back to this limitation of use situation, and it just appears to me, the newcomer in this, that...
Wait, are we having questions, or are we having discussion now? Are we still in public comment?
We need to, if you have a question directly for the applicant, go ahead and ask that at this point.
That's what I'm getting at.
Okay, go ahead.
Sorry.
Okay.
That needs to be taken up at some point in time, but... some others, AT&T has pulled out from a request and moved somewhere else. You mentioned Hearst Castle. I'm sure it's not in the cupola of the castle, and they got 80,000 acres to work with. But my point is there not a site easterly, which gets pretty rugged, and some rancher's hilltop somewhere, is up Bea Creek or wherever it might be, that would accomplish the same thing without crowding it into a 1.8 square area?
I guess potentially that is an option. However, based upon the ordinance, sort of the preferable method is to incorporate these antennas into architectural features rather than come up with a ridgetop site that would be a new, what I call vertical projection, which would be a tree up on a ridge, which perhaps staff can comment a little bit more on that. And to also touch on the limitation of use, several times in the past, I believe there are three other wireless projects where the commission has basically acknowledged that there is this limitation of use and allowed for cell sites. So this is definitely within your power to direct staff to come back forth with conditions of approval for the project and move forward with approval.
I was on the commission then. I don't have any questions.
If there's no other questions, thank you.
Thank you.
Any more public comment? Yeah, there is. All right, I'll go ahead and open up public comment. I've got one speaker slip from Ryan Shields.
That was.
Oh, that's you?
Yeah, I wasn't sure.
Oh, I'm sorry. Great. No, we do need a speaker slip. Appreciate that. If there's no other public comment, we'll go ahead and close public comment. I don't know if staff would like to make any comments regarding the applicant's comments. All right. Well, we will bring it back to the commission for deliberations.
Yes.
And this represents all districts. With any, well, your lights on, you get to go first.
Is it his district?
Oh, I'm sorry. It is his district. I'm thinking of the next hearing. Yeah.
Well, it does represent all districts in a sense, because it, the question that that I struggled with on this one, and I went back and actually checked the previous video clips, And the good news about the video records we have for Planning Commission hearings is that they're there and they're accessible and they're very informative. The bad news is that they take a long time to be used. So I listened to every one of those particular precedent hearings. And to me, what struck me was that in each of those cases, you're talking about towers. Correct me if I'm wrong. I don't think there was any of those three that were cited in the staff report that that involved a hidden facility such as this. And now I might have that wrong.
But no, you're correct.
Okay. So then I got to thinking, well, why San Simeon and not Cambria? Because we have the reason I asked about Cambria is we got this the Santa Rosa Church bell tower, which was raised to enable installation of a hidden antenna, for which I was very grateful as a resident because I was able to
use regularity. We added wireless communications into the communications facilities use group because that was the place it made the most sense to be. So a lot of times you see those limitation on use standards. Those were written prior to wireless being a part of that bigger use group. And so the thought was, well, you didn't want KSBY, big radio or big TV station building in the midst of San Simeon, let's say. And so that's the reason you see them as prohibited uses. We recognize that wireless as a component of that bigger use group does make sense in a lot of these areas, but because of the way that our ordinances and general plan are set up, our hands are kind of tied. In inland, we are working on a correction to that. We're going to look through all of the limitation on use standards and see where it is that we can add communication facilities with this parenthetical that's only for wireless. In coastal, of course, it's a local coastal plan amendment, which are often more difficult to do. But that is one of the options, is for the county to try and go back and fix these. The other place we can fix it is to amend the ordinance itself in wireless and say where a wireless facility is clearly incidental to an existing use and completely stealth, that it could be found as maybe an accessory use. Again, in inland, that's really easy to do because it's our process and our amendment. In coastal, not so easy to do because it's a local coastal plan amendment. But that's where it comes from.
So the difference between San Simeon and Cambria?
I'm assuming it was San Simeon was smaller and it was felt it might not be appropriate to have those kinds of uses there, where Cambria was bigger and the idea of having a radio station in Cambria or a TV station in Cambria was thought to be more logical.
Well, there was
both of these communities and the North Coast Area Plan were written when? This is the issue, is when was this written?
Well, so these original limitation on use standards, originally were probably adopted in 1980 with the LUO-LUE right. And then further refined or agreed to with the local coastal plan in 88. And, yeah, we didn't do our wireless as a subset of communication facilities until the 90s.
Right.
Yeah,
right.
90s.
Okay.
Okay, so then reading between the lines on the staff report, I understand that you could go across the street to the RM and apply for a fake tree.
Correct.
Without this impediment.
Correct.
Yeah. Not that it would automatically be approved, because nothing is automatically approved by communities on the North Coast.
But the standard wouldn't apply.
Yeah. So, and this is a hidden facility, and it's one of several. There are two other hidden facilities in the area. One being the Santa Rosa Church, which you absolutely can't see anything other than a bell tower. And I take it the other one is hidden in the East Village, because I would have noticed it.
Okay.
Okay. Well, so I'm wondering, we talked last week about some obsolescence in our title, our code, and so this is clearly seems to me to be something that is technical, in a technical obsolescence, in that you can hide these facilities, and yet if that happens to have been excluded as a use, then the only thing that can be done about it is that the commission can. What's the formal? What's the way around this? And I guess
alternative action.
Okay.
Read your alternative action. That's the way around it.
Okay. Is that what I want to do? Is
I don't know if you want to do it, but that's if you. I mean, it's right here in the staff report.
Okay. So. Well, I'm trying to understand the alternative action that continue the project to a future hearing to allow staff to complete the environmental.
Do you want me to step in?
Et cetera.
I was part of the commission during the Sea Pines and the Bartleson and the BKS Cambria applications, and I was part of the majority of the commission in Sea Pines that decided that despite the language of the area plans limiting the use, communications facility use, that cell phones are essential infrastructure, and they are incidental to use to residents, commercial, tourists, whatever. It doesn't really matter if there are people around. They need really not just want to use their cell phones.
It can be considered as a project.
Right, and in this case, I think if your commission wanted to find that because of the accessory nature of the use to the existing hotel or motel use, some kind of finding like that to send staff back with would be helpful.
Okay.
And then we would go back, complete environmental review, and come back to you with conditions and all of that kind of stuff.
Okay. So moved. this is essential infrastructure for the area, and it's been permitted in other situations which were technically different. It'll be hidden from view and will add to the emergency response capabilities as well as the tourism capabilities of the area. And it's an accessory, and it's essentially an accessory to the main use, which will be totally screened. And for those reasons, I recommend that commission take action to agree with the applicant's interpretation of the limitation on use standard. The commission and that the commission continue the project to a future hearing to allow staff to complete the environmental determination, prepare conditions, and bring it back to the commission for approval.
I'll second that.
Commissioners, we would like that to be continued to a date certain.
Okay.
And so,
how about August?
No. We're suggesting July 25th.
Yeah. Okay. That'd be fine.
Okay.
So, I'd like to make that as part of the motion, July 25th.
And did your motion include the concept that we do find that this application is incidental and secondary to the main use?
Yes, accessory. Correct.
Yeah, when the staff report mentioned that this is a tourist-serving area, if you have tourists, they want to be able to use their cell phones.
Yeah, I go by.
You need to.
I walk on Moonstone Beach Drive, and Moonstone Beach Boardwalk, and here's all these poor tourists out here standing on the boardwalk because across the street in the motels they can't get cell service. So that's the reason I asked about that.
My second concurs with the date.
Okay.
Okay. So I just want to ask staff, on the Sea Pines report, you talked about that it would be possible to approve it if it was appurtenant to and necessary for the resort, and the finding staff position that it wasn't at that time. And then you also talked about it not being accessory. So why do those come into play, so to speak? What is the overriding condition, it allows us to go, so again, so to speak, the planning standard, if it's an accessory use or if it's appurtenant to another use. Are we taking position that because it's not the primary use, that it doesn't really necessarily have to be treated as a separate issue, that it's an accessory or appurtenant to the existing primary use?
Erlandstingwald Planning, I think the logic there is that the commission felt in those previous cases that the standard was intended to apply to the primary use of that site, and it wasn't intended to prohibit other ancillary accessory uses that could be necessary to support that primary use,
okay,
such as cell site.
So that's the premise we're going forward on, and the conditions will reflect that position of the commission then.
The findings.
Findings will be, okay. Any other discussion? If not, we'll take a vote. Roll call.
Commissioner Topping?
Yes.
Commissioner Campbell?
Yes.
Commissioner Christensen?
Yes.
And Chairperson Murphy?
Yes. Motion approved. We continued it to July 25th. Right, if you'll announce the next item, please.
County of San Luis Obispo for an amendment to Titles 19, 22, and 23. County file number LRP 2012-00009. Supervisorial District All. Project Manager Michael Conger.
Is there any ex parte to disclose? All right, Mr. Conger.
Good morning, Chair Murphy and members of the Commission. I'm Michael Conger with County Planning Staff, and the project we're going to be discussing right now is Stormwater Management Ordinance Package, which includes amendments to Titles 19, 22, and 23 of the County Code. To give you a project description, the Board is our permitting agency for California, so they issue what's called the State General Permit, and that permit gets updated every 5 years. And we're covered under a state general permit for municipal stormwater discharges, and that's often called the MS4 general permit. That permit requires that we develop a stormwater management program, and our program calls for us to develop county ordinances that are enforceable. Those ordinances then call for individual project applicants to provide information in their project plans, and that information comes in the form of erosion control plans, stormwater pollution prevention plans, stormwater control plans, grading plans, things like that. The phenomenon we're trying to control for with these regulations is something called hydromodification. And hydromodification happens as a result of urbanization. And these two hydrologic models, the one on the left shows a pre-development model, the one on the right shows a post-development. And in the pre-development model, you'll see that 10% of the precipitation winds up running off. Whereas in the post-development model, that goes up to 55%. And so the amount of runoff is increased by a factor of 5 when land becomes urbanized. And as runoff volume increases and runoff velocity increases, runoff directions change, runoff concentration increases, and peak flow increases as a result of urbanization, the effect we get is channelization of streams, erosion of stream banks, loss of aquatic habitat, less recharge to the aquifer, which is particularly important in areas where, like the Paso Robles groundwater basin, where the aquifer is the main source of water, and then higher pollutant load in the streams. And so this is an example of some hydromodification. You can see how the stream banks have actually, the physical characteristics of the stream is changing as a result of the drainage circumstances here. So the way we address hydromodification, we address it with two different phases, the during construction, the construction phase stuff, and then the post-construction phase stuff. The during construction phase is regulated through the erosion and sedimentation control plan, the drainage plan, the grading plan, and something called a stormwater pollution prevention plan. And each of those are triggered based on different thresholds, and the requirements and standards are based on those thresholds as well. After construction, for the life of the project, we don't really have a way of monitoring how stormwater happens. So if someone buys a parcel, for example, and they've got a large drainage basin in their front yard, we don't have a procedure where we can make sure that that drainage basin doesn't get filled in and lose its functionality as a stormwater device. So this regulation would require that all applicants develop a stormwater control plan that's going to tell us how the stormwater gets controlled on the site for the operational phase. They'll also have to enter into a maintenance agreement if there are structural stormwater control measures, and there's also an annual reporting requirement. And the county, in turn, then needs to aggregate those reports and report back to the Regional Water Quality Control Board on compliance. So this ordinance, the post-construction standards will apply only to areas that are considered MS4 areas. And when you see this MS4 abbreviation, it stands for Municipal Separate Storm Sewer System. And that's basically the municipal stormwater system that the county operates. It includes our county roads, our county the gutters alongside the roads. And any water that enters the municipal stormwater system is subject to that state general permit and becomes the county's responsibility. MS4 areas include all the incorporated cities, several census-designated places, several community services districts, and then additional areas that are considered urbanized by the U.S. Census, which may not be in an urban or village reserve line. And the tool we're using to address the hydro modification is something called low-impact development. You may also hear the abbreviation LID. That's a common phrase. The difference between LID and the way we've conventionally handled drainage, conventionally our main focus is flood control. We want to get the water off of the site and into a stream and downriver as soon as possible, whereas low-impact development seeks to mimic the natural hydrology. So where I showed that first image of the two hydrologic cycles, we want to get back to having things like increasing evapotranspiration, increasing the percolation into the groundwater basin and things like that. And so on the left, these are some extreme contrasting techniques, but on the left we see the traditional conventional methods where we gather the drainage and pipe it, and this is the Los Angeles River, which is an extreme example of hydro modification where they've actually cemented in the stream banks and the stream bed itself so it no longer even functions as a river. On the right hand side we've got the more LID friendly techniques, which include things like these bioswales and depressed vegetated areas where water can enter and get treated. And so this is a zoom in here. This just shows a few techniques that this in the conservation and open space element by adopting this. There's different types of best management practices for LID, and so we're going to focus on a few different kinds. Site design is one of them, and site design and runoff reduction, I should point out, are supply side. So the idea is we're trying to reduce the amount of water we're working with, whereas water quality treatment and runoff retention is now that we've got this water, now we're trying to deal with it. Site design it's doing things that maintain existing natural features. It's reducing the amount of area that's going to be graded. Runoff reduction is trying to do things to reduce the amount of runoff that's going to come from the site, and water quality treatment would be treatment through a bioswale. Runoff retention would be using a retention basin and percolating the water through to the groundwater basin. So BMPs for site design include retaining natural hydrology, building on the poorest percolating soils so that you're retaining the best percolating soils undeveloped. Reducing building footprints, reducing vegetation removal. And so here's an example. This is, again, a very contrasting example between a conventional subdivision and a cluster subdivision. In this cluster subdivision, they've made an attempt to maintain this creek corridor and a few of these other drainage areas, whereas in a conventional subdivision, the whole area would be subdivided and each property would have private ownership of those things. And then an additional example here is cut and fill grading and versus terracing on steep slopes. Oftentimes we'll have applicants who will come in and they'll have had their architect design their house without having seen the site. And so we'll get a single story house, but the site has a 20% slope. And that type of thing is extremely discouraged through this. You really need to look at the site conditions and try to mimic the site conditions as much as possible. As far as runoff reduction, here's a few ideas. Pervious pavers, green roof, directing roof runoff to vegetated areas, directing pavement runoff to vegetated areas, and rainwater harvesting. And we've got a few pictures here. This is turf block. This is using a rain barrel. This is directing a downspout into a vegetated area, and this is porous asphalt and a green roof over here. For water quality treatment, the main tool is vegetated swales or bioswales. Another tool that we see oftentimes with wineries is constructed wetlands. And then there's also vegetated buffers and mechanical devices such as a vortex-based system. And so this is the basic concept of water quality treatment. We're taking the roof runoff, we're running it into a bioswale or a bioretention cell, and the plants will absorb the nutrients. The pollutants will get, filtered out through the soil before the water leaves the site. And so this winds up treating all of the stormwater, so the water we get running off into the county system winds up being clean. And so here's an example of a few water quality treatment devices in practice. As far as runoff retention goes, the basic tool for that is using retention basins. Okay, so I'm going to go through the four performance measures for the post-construction standards. And these are triggered, first of all, you have to be in an MS4 area, so rural areas are not subject to these standards. And the triggers depend on what the net impervious square footage of surfacing is proposed on the project. So we're looking at what you have now plus what you have proposed. We're looking at the difference between what you have now and what you're proposing. At 2,500 square feet, you trigger the first performance measure of site design. At 5,000 square feet for anything but a single family development, you'll trigger the second performance measure of treatment. At 15,000 square feet, you trigger retention, and at 22,500 square feet, you trigger peak management. And I'll just go through what these requirements are really quickly. The first measure, runoff reduction, at 2,500 square feet, the goal is to preserve the natural hydrology and reduce the runoff. And the standard is to limit disturbance of creeks, minimize soil compaction, limit clearing and grading, and then you have to choose one LID measure, and examples are rainwater harvesting and directing runoff to vegetated areas. So basically, that first house I showed you, that would be most single-family residences would trigger this measure, and as long as they did what that house did, they'd comply with the standard. The second measure of water quality treatment triggers at 5,000 square feet, but not up to 15,000 square feet for single-family residences. And the goal here is to treat the runoff using LID measures, and the standard is that those LID measures need to be sized for the 85th percentile storm event. For the third measure of runoff retention that triggers 15,000 square feet, the goal is to retain and infiltrate stormwater. And depending on which watershed management zone, that's the WMZ on the screen, depending on which watershed management zone, you may need to retain and infiltrate for the 95th percentile storm event or the 85th percentile storm event. And some watershed by with the stormwater measurements by doing off-site measures, but the only way to do that is to actually trigger trigger one of these alternative compliance measures. Technical infeasibility, if you can demonstrate that you can't physically retain and infiltrate 95th percentile amount of stormwater, for example, then you might qualify as technically infeasible, in which case you're able to dedicate 10% of your site to retention, and you've met that performance requirement. And then these other programs, urban sustainability area, this was a response the regional board gave to a lot of the municipalities' concerns about urban infill development and how this might impact that because of needing to dedicate site area for stormwater measures and things like that. The urban sustainability area criteria that the regional boards developed is set at about 30 dwelling units per acre, so it's probably not something that we'd be able to use in this county, although we are working with them to see if we can revise those standards. Another way of doing it is to develop a watershed management plan for an area. For example, taking the Napomo area, doing a watershed management program that involved using regional stormwater basins rather than individual property stormwater basins. That's something that the county could pursue as well. And then there's a section on other circumstances for highly altered drainage channels and historic lakes and wetlands that most likely do not apply to this county. The ordinance requirements, the first requirement is that applicants submit a stormwater control plan that tells us the long-term stormwater control measures and identifies the BMPs that they're going to use. That needs to be submitted at the earliest phase in the project. So if you're filing for a subdivision, we need to have that information at the subdivision level. And the reason is because the stormwater quality measures could actually dictate site design to some extent. We also have a maintenance agreement requirement. The maintenance agreement is only required where you have a structural stormwater device, like a retention basin, that we need to report on an annual basis that it's still functioning in good condition, so that we can then report to the regional board that we're monitoring that information. The effect of the ordinance is that site design needs to start becoming the first consideration in projects. Drainage and hydrology has to be addressed as early as possible, so people are going to need to start hiring the engineer before they hire the architect to look at the site conditions and then have the architect develop a house that fits to the site, or develop the commercial project that fits to the site and incorporates natural hydrology as much as possible. And as I said before, in many cases, the stormwater control measures are going to drive the design. If you have a 95th percentile retention requirement and you have poorly infiltrating soils, you're going to need a large basin, which means less of your lot can be developed. There's potential added costs as a result of this, having to do the engineered drainage calculations early on and potentially revising them as the site plan goes through the process. That's one. Land costs because of the less developable area, and then maintenance costs associated with maintaining the devices and then reporting on an annual basis. The other component of the ordinance is the Coastal Zone Land Use Ordinance, which was originally reviewed by your commission in 2010. The Coastal Zone Land Use Ordinance, this is just a little bit of background on it. We've had a grading ordinance in the Coastal Zone since 1988, I believe. And in 2001, the Coastal Commission identified it as part of the periodic review. They identified some concerns specifically with agricultural grading. In 2003, the Coastal Commission denied an attempt to update the grading ordinance. We wound up updating it in the inland area and not in the coastal area at that time. In 2010, the board adopted an updating grading ordinance, both inland and coastal. The inland ordinance has been in effect since May 2010. The coastal ordinance had to go through the Coastal Commission review process, and the Coastal Commission adopted a modified version of the ordinance in 2012. They had about 35 different modifications to the board's coastal grading ordinance. And of those 35 modifications, there were three modifications that had to do with agricultural grading, which actually went beyond the scope of the ordinance amendment that we had made. And so the board wound up rejecting the Coastal Commission modifications in January of this year, largely as a result of the modifications made to the agricultural grading item. So our approach now on the Coastal Zone Grading Ordinance is we're including all of the board-adopted language except the language revising agricultural grading. So we're no longer proposing the alternative review program, for example. We're including all of the Coastal Commission modifications except those pertaining to the agricultural cultivation. And we're retaining the existing grading exemption for agricultural cultivation, which has been in our ordinance since 1988. And so that's the approach we've taken with the Coastal Zone Grading Ordinance at this point. And the idea is we're hoping to submit this again to the Coastal Commission to adopt as part of these stormwater management updates. So, as I mentioned, also the construction phase, and I'm available for any questions.
I have one, Mr. Chairman. Curiosity, the stormwater event, the 85%, what was that based on? 100-year flood, 10-year average, or what's the basis of coming up with the percentage?
I'm not an engineer, and so I might turn over to Public Works to comment a little bit on that, but my understanding is it's based on the rainfall level for an individual site, and you're looking at the, I believe it's back-to-back storm events. I could be wrong. I don't know if Mr. Honeycutt has anything to add in on that.
It's an inverse way of saying the same thing we've always said. So a 100-year storm is a storm that has a 1% chance of happening. So either way, you look over the history of rainfall and you draw the line somewhere. You say everything above this we're going to count and everything below we're not going to count.
Thank you.
Any other questions of the staff at this point? If not, I'll open public comment. I do not have any speakers. I don't see anybody else in the room, so I will close public comment. Staff's the applicant, so I guess we're at commission deliberations. Actually, I've got Mr. Topping's name popped up first. So.
Oh, that's all right.
No, it's okay. Any questions?
Couple of questions. While you're on the subject of stormwater. Sorry.
There. While you're on the subject of 100-year floods, what about standard flood hazard areas? In other words, the NFIP flood zones or the overlay zones. Is there any relationship between the low-impact development? What would be the relationship between LID measures that would be taken in an area which may be a 100-year flood zone specifically? Is there any difference?
I would say, generally speaking, the 100-year flood zones are in watershed management zone number one, which is one that would require the 95th percentile retention and infiltration. So they would assume that you've got the soils that you're able to retain and infiltrate if you're in a flood area. So I think that would be the best way to answer that.
Maybe I could add, perhaps one way to look at the LID is it's a bag of tools. You don't use the same tool on every job.
Right.
So if you're in an area with soil that perks well, some features work better. There's already an indication if you have soils that don't perk well, then using infiltration methods is not going to be very effective. If you're in an area that's in a floodplain, two things to consider. A 100-year storm, you might say, is a 85th percentile storm that's mentioned in the ordinance would not be the same thing as a floodplain. So while you could build a house in a floodplain, provided you elevated above the floodplain, you would still have to implement some of these LID measures.
Okay.
So the vegetation tools, I guess we can say they're mentioned there, would still be a good idea.
Okay. A couple other questions, Mr. Chair.
Sure.
I'm thinking about how does this impact more intense development, commercial development, clusters. You're talking about reserving more land area for water absorption or water retention. And the question is, if we want to promote more intense development in selected areas for smart growth purposes, is there any conflict?
And that is a potential conflict that a number of the municipalities have raised with the Regional Water Quality Control Board. They don't particularly agree. They don't feel that there's a nexus between having additional requirements on urban level development and pushing development out into the rural areas, which was a concern that was raised. The way that they addressed going around that is by developing this urban sustainability area idea as a way of doing off-site stormwater management. I know the city of Paso Robles is pursuing an urban sustainability area right now for their downtown area. But the problem is we don't right now have the criteria for what qualifies as an urban sustainability area and what the regional board would accept as one.
I'm just thinking there may be a policy conflict between our general plan and
So over time, when we've had these comments go through to the regional board, they've made a number of modifications to the standards to make it less punitive on urban infill development. We're still not certain how these requirements are going to be in effect because we haven't implemented them yet. And so we're not, you know, completely certain with what the impact would be, but the tough requirements trigger at 15,000 square feet of impervious surfacing. So if you're able to reduce below that threshold, you've reduced below the runoff retention requirement at least.
So we encourage land divisions in order to accommodate.
Well, a land division would have to develop a stormwater control plan as well. What we would encourage is that someone use pervious pavers or use a green roof or use a number of different measures to reduce the amount of runoff and reduce the amount of impervious surfacing so that they're below that threshold and don't trigger that standard.
Another question I had was changes of ownership over time, the agreements. Would that be handled through CC&Rs?
The maintenance agreement records on title, and so that would get transferred to the new owner.
Okay. Could you, and my last question is the maps that we have in here, these are, this legend says areas subject to stormwater standards, and these are a mixture of urban, village, and incorporated city areas, right?
Correct.
So it's what applies to both the county, these parts of the county areas, and as well as the incorporated cities.
The way that the regional board defines the urbanized areas is completely different than the way our general plan defines them. And so we tried to make it easy. We tried to say all urban reserve line areas are subject to these standards. Certain village reserve lines are. I think there's only three villages that aren't, and I think those are Creston, Pozo, and Whitley Gardens that aren't subject to the stormwater standards. So most villages are. And then on top of it, there's certain rural areas that aren't in a village, they're not in an urban area, there's no other way to define them other than mapping them. Mm-hmm. And so that's the reason the maps are in there, is to show those areas that are outside of the urban reserve line, but are also still subject to the stormwater standards.
So if a city annexes an area, then does that automatically modify the map?
If a city annexes an area, it would then be subject to the city's ordinance.
Yeah, but it would fall under the same requirement.
It would fall under these requirements are the same throughout the Central Coast region, and each city will have to adopt an ordinance like this.
Because that's a moving target, and the individual city ordinance would apply to any annexations.
Correct.
Okay.
All right. Commissioner Christensen.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Mr. Conger, for a great report, as having waded through the grading ordinance a couple years ago with you. I feel much better equipped to take a look at this, and I understand the reasons for doing it. I don't really have any specific concerns. I just had a couple questions. One of them is regarding, if you could look at page 2-48 of your staff report. On the exemptions from grading permits.
Okay.
And it just that note that's on the top, is that actually part of the ordinance? Is that going to stay in there, or is that just a note to us?
We actually wanted that to stay in the ordinance. We were keeping that note in there just to remind people and reinforce the notion that even if you're exempt from a grading permit, you still have to get state and federal permits.
Right. One of the things that was a big problem just for the education of the current commission is that we see a lot of unpermitted, improper grading throughout the county, and the idea of updating the grading permit was to try to deal with some of that. And so it's good to see notes like this that are just educational for folks, so they can't be told by their bulldozer operator, oh, don't worry, you know, it's ag, or don't worry, it's this, you don't need a permit. Sometimes you may not need a permit from the county, but you need to understand that just taking a bulldozer to a hillside or to, you know, a creek or whatever is not necessarily going to be okay. Even if you have technically an exemption on one ground, you might not have it in other jurisdictions or for other reasons. So yeah, so I'm glad to see that the notes are going to stay in the actual language. And the other part is just about this agricultural. Agricultural permits or agricultural grading. So when we did the inland part and we had We talked a lot about agricultural grading and when it should be exempt and when it should not be exempt.
I say that this will accomplish compliance with the state mandate, implementation of several general plan policies. How does that square with page 2-173, the resolution disagreeing with the Coastal Commission's blah, blah, blah? How do those two things square, which was signed by the Board of Supervisors in January?
That resolution is in regards to the Coastal Commission modifications made to the Coastal Zone Grading Ordinance, and we've excluded the modifications that the Board of Supervisors specifically disagreed with on this version.
Okay. Thank you.
I guess I didn't try and compare the Regional Water Quality Control Board's document with our document, so I see some really rigid requirements in there. Are we trying to incorporate everything that they've put in there, or are we incorporating what we feel is necessary to meet the requirements of the law? I'm just thinking of not parking your truck in an open lot, but having to put it under a structure so that the rain doesn't wash grease and oil off the truck and it flows into a creek or flows into a watershed. Steam cleaning your equipment at a restaurant. There's all kinds of requirements in there. Are we blanket adopting all those type of requirements, or are we just implementing what is going to be in our ordinance?
What we're doing is three things. We're requiring a stormwater control plan that documents how you're complying with the post-construction requirements. So as part of filing the stormwater control plan, you're going to need to show us how you meet those requirements. Those requirements are being established by the Regional Water Quality Control Board rather than the county. And so we're pointing to those requirements by reference. And the stormwater control plan will be reviewed by county staff to ensure that it complies with the post-construction requirements. There's still some uncertainty, for example, as to what qualifies technical infeasibility and what doesn't. And each jurisdiction is going to have to develop their own policies and guidelines for that right now. I know the Public Works Department has a contract with a consultant who's working on a guidance document for applicants right now that's going to address a lot of that stuff.
So there's another hearing coming up. I guess it's the Regional Water Quality Control Board, where they may modify their plan.
Right. To give you a little history, the Regional Board adopted these post-construction requirements September 6th of 2012. Shortly after that, the state general permit was being modified at the state level. The state general permit, as a result of that getting adopted, they somehow unraveled the adoption of the post-construction requirements from September 6, 2012. And so the regional board, that adoption, that order is null and void at this point. They now need to go back through and readopt. As part of their readoption, they're working on a number of numerical issues, such as quantifying or calculating the sizing of stormwater basins, issues that were raised by the engineering community. And so the version that they're planning to adopt July 12 is basically the September 6, 2012 language with some tweaks and amendments to satisfy a lot of the concerns that the engineering community had brought up.
And this would go to our Board of Supervisors after the Regional Water Quality Commission.
Correct. We're aiming for August for the Board of Supervisors. The ordinance, as it stands right now, is required to be adopted and in effect by September 6.
And did I read that this particular regional plan only applies to a group of coastal counties?
Correct. There's nine regional water quality control boards. The state general permit sets the requirements for the state. As part of the state general permit, they've written out a watershed-specific post-construction program that a regional board could do on their own. And our regional board has undertaken that program.
And so
our requirements, this 95th percentile, for example, that's a requirement that we don't see elsewhere in the state.
And they're one of the few regional boards that's actually done this. Is that right?
This is the only regional board that has adopted a regional-based hydro modification thing based on our own watershed processes. Other regional boards may also undertake that in the future.
All right. Seems like a lot of regulations to me, but apparently we're subject to the state. So the general, when you get your general permit, do they look to see if you comply? Or how often does a general permit for the county have to be renewed or reapproved?
The general permit generally gets changed every 5 years, but we have to report on compliance to the regional board on an annual basis every July. And then they'll review our report, and they'll go through and they'll identify any areas where we have a potential violation, and then it's our responsibility to go and fix that.
I got it. One other question.
Commissioner Topping.
Yeah, I agree this is a well-written report, and I want to thank you for that. One thing that I wasn't sure whether I saw or not was the clarity of the Regional Water Quality Board that suggests what kind of water savings might be, percolation might ultimately be gained.
I don't know if it's being quantified, but I know, for example, with the Paso Robles groundwater basin, implementing an LID ordinance was one of the potential recommendations that the Blue Ribbon Committee had come up with.
Okay.
Yeah, I suspect the gross area being developed is rather tiny compared to the size of our county, so I don't know that the water savings will be dramatic, but it all adds up. So, I mean, in Napomo, they put in several underground retentions that are pretty nice, and that water, though in Napomo, not a lot of water flows away anyway, typically, number one, because it never rains, and number two, it's in
Santa. Do you want a motion?
Sure.
I would like to go ahead and move that the recommend to the Board of Supervisors approval of Land Use Ordinance Amendment LRP 2012-00009 based on the findings listed in Exhibit A.
Is there a second?
Second.
Roll call, please.
Commissioner Christensen?
Aye.
Commissioner Topping?
Yes.
Commissioner Campbell?
Yes.
And Chairperson Murphy?
Yes.
Thank you very much.
All right. Motion was approved. At this point, I would like a motion to take all testimony documents into the record.
So moved.
Is there a second?
Second.
All in favor?
Aye.
Opposed?
Aye.
Motion passes. The motion to adjourn is to our next regularly scheduled meeting, July 11, 2013.
So moved.
Second? I guess don't require a second, I don't believe. All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Meeting adjourned. Ta-da. 10:20.